it's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Census has been the subject of political and legal battles this year, and the COVID-19 pandemic delayed its in-person operations. We'll talk with a census historian about how it's dealt with obstacles in the past. First, a new-to-Netflix docudrama features tech industry insiders like former Facebook, Twitter, and Google engineers and execs talking about the problematic angle to the social media giants they helped to propel into the world. Here are a few of them talking about the seriousness of the issue in the movie The Social Dilemma.
They know when people are lonely. They know when people are depressed. They know when people are looking at photos of your ex-romantic partners. They know what you're doing late at night. They know the entire thing.
Whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, or what kind of neuroses you have, what your personality type is like.
They have more information about us than has ever been imagined in human history.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch The Social Dilemma? What did you think? Are you worried about the algorithms getting smarter or how social media use might be changing our society or us? Do you feel the urge to limit or eliminate your presence on social media platforms? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve Knoll is a marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
So, Steve, what were your initial impressions of the documentary?
Well, I'm happy that people are watching it and talking about it. I think it's really important that people understand the business of social media. There's a lot of misinformation about it. So any opportunity to kind of talk about how this works, I think it's valuable for all people to know it. Personally, as someone who's been teaching this stuff for over 10 years, I'm happy to say I really didn't learn anything new. So I guess that's good. But at the same point, too, I did find the movie was a little manipulative in how it presented some of the information.
Well, and that's interesting because it is definitely a sense of impending doom, I would say, kind of hangs over it. And these are heavy hitters, big players, you know, people who started or ran things like Instagram and Twitter and Google and, you know, name any social media platform. And they had people from there who are expressing serious concern. Do you think that their concerns are valid?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the idea that people should really understand how social media companies monetize people is very important. I think everyone really should understand it's a business and how a business works. I just thought the movie was kind of manipulative and at one point they're talking about how companies shouldn't be manipulating you to feel certain ways. But yet the documentary was absolutely manipulating you to feel a certain way. So,
well, and that's nothing new either. That's certainly not unique to social media or technology.
Absolutely not. And I mean, it's an entertaining documentary, which I appreciate. I think some of the stuff when you start talking about, like, you know, algorithms and clickstream personality touch points gets a little dry and technical. And at least the movie presented it in an entertaining way that is easily digestible for the average person that doesn't necessarily know a lot about what these terms mean.
I think one of the points that I found really interesting, and as you said, nothing new, but I thought they said it really well, is that basically there's nothing is free. And so if you are using a service and not paying for it, that means you're the product. It's not.
Yes. And that's an old marketing expression. If something's free, you're the product. And this is something that, you know, when people, you know, complain about, oh, I don't like how Facebook is, you know, I look up, you know, some shoes on a website and then a second later, here's an ad for it on Facebook. You have to remember, consumers overwhelmingly want that business model. They want the internet to be free. So in other words, they want to use products without paying for them. And when the internet really became a force in the 90s, there was this big debate about business models. You know, do we go down an advertising supported road where you provide a free product, so to say, in exchange for advertising on it? Or do you do a subscription based product? And consumers overwhelmingly rejected the idea that subscription based was even an option. They wanted the internet to be free. So they felt that they already had to pay to have a service provider to get to the internet. They felt once they're on the internet, everything should be free. As a result, it enabled these companies to really take that business model and blow it up and basically say, okay, consumers, you wanted it to be free. You want to be on it all day long and not get a bill at the end of the day. Well, here's the trade-off is it costs money to run Facebook. It costs money to run Google. And if consumers aren't, you know, contributing with their pocketbooks, they've got to contribute with their personality.
Right. So we're not paying in cash, but we're paying in data.
You're paying in data. Yes, yes. And there's actually a good thing about that. One of the nicest things about social media marketing is that it gives the ability for companies to market a specific product to a specific end user. And when I teach an advertising class, one of the first things I say is who doesn't like advertising? And of course, everyone raises their hands. And then I say, but can you name a commercial you loved? And everyone starts spouting out all these famous commercials. And I'm like, so you love advertising, but you hate it. You know, the answer is humans love advertising as long as it's relevant to them as an individual. And before social media, advertising had this kind of scattershot approach. You'd put an ad on TV or on the radio or something, knowing that thousands, if not millions of people would be exposed to it, but only maybe 5 or 10% would actually buy your product. So 90% of your budget was wasted, and that was acceptable to get to those 10%. Nowadays, companies can say, you know what, you're into skiing because you post about it on Instagram, so we're going to show you ads for skiing-related products. And if somebody has zero interest in skiing, we're not going to show you the ads. So in a way, it's actually a good business model because it allows you to see ads only for products that you actually are interested in. Plus, of course, it costs companies a lot less money because that 90% waste isn't being wasted because you're only talking to those, you know, skiers. You know, so that as a business model, it's actually a really good, very good for both the consumer and a business way of doing things. However, this is still a new medium. And if you really look at the history of advertising and marketing, anytime a new medium develops, newspaper, you know, 150 years ago or so, radio 100 years ago, television in the 40s and 50s, all the mediums took years to really, people had to explore how they worked, what didn't work, and all that. And there's always been an ethical component to mass medium, no matter what it is. And social media really is really been around about 15 years. 2006 is kind of considered the mainstreaming of social media. That's the year that Facebook basically opened it up to everyone that wasn't a student. So we are still in an industry that is still figuring out how to walk, and it's already running. So people are making a lot of ethical mistakes, and some of them are intentional, some of them are accidental. I think Facebook, being the biggest well-known company, even though they're not really the biggest, Google's the biggest, but Facebook really has gone in with a very naive attitude that, you know, human beings will always choose to do the right thing. And that's just not a human characteristic. And as a result, there have been a lot of unethical behavior, especially on Facebook, that really Facebook needs to address. So I'm happy that we're having conversations like this, because as much as I think social media is a wonderful thing, you know, the more that consumers can understand how it works, the harder it's going to be for people to use it unethically.
We're talking with Steve Knoll right now. He's a marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. We're talking about the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, which is about social media, and we're putting it into context. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you care about or worry about all the data that big tech companies are collecting while we're online? If you watched the documentary, what stood out to you? Do you think we're too worried about social media use or not worried enough? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And no irony intended, you can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment and take your calls here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Steve Knoll, marketing instructor and social media expert at Madison College. We're talking about the documentary, The Social Dilemma. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch The Social Dilemma on Netflix? How did you manage your own social media use, and has it changed over time? What about your kids' online presence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones, and Ray in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Ray.
Hi, what really angers me about these big giant tech companies, and it appears the European community has a better handle on privacy since we have no laws about privacy here, but the thing that makes my blood boil, $1 trillion companies paying zero in state and federal taxes, and we all wonder why our schools are so messed up, why our streets are so messed up, and why especially the states, have gotten such a raw deal on this whole big tech thing. And maybe the guests could elaborate a little bit about the difference between the European community and their view of privacy and our lack of that here, sure. And then also what they pay in taxes.
Great. Thanks for that call, Ray. And Steve, first of all, maybe let's talk about that privacy issue. Does it matter significantly what country you're living in, how much privacy you have online?
Well, and yes, I mean, the internet is global for the most part. And, you know, that's something that we really started seeing in the last few years. In fact, when people just even go to a website, you're probably going to see a cookie notice pop up, you know, if the website uses cookies. A lot of this originated out of Europe and specifically France. The country of France has a lot of very specific privacy laws. It's part of their culture a lot more. That is a big difference between French culture and U.S. culture. So as a result, France really originated a lot of these internet privacy laws that basically said, if you are a business doing business in the country of France, you need to follow our laws. And then from France, it kind of grew into the EU supporting it. And as a result, that's a big chunk of the world for companies like Facebook and Google to not be doing business in. So as a result, even here in the United States, we've seen the last few years kind of an uptick in, you know, some privacy stuff, a lot more call to awareness about it. So when you are visiting these sites, you're going to see more information about privacy, that, you know, that we have cookies, and a lot of it is you can thank, if you like that, you can thank countries like France that really kind of force these companies to say, hey, if you want to play, you have to play by our rules first, and it does affect the world. So I think that's a good thing. And again, you know, my whole thing is consumers should know how this how these businesses work, because it makes you a smarter consumer, it makes you a better consumer, and it makes you a safer consumer.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little off the topic of the documentary, but Ray also asked about how much they're paying in taxes, where that huge amount of wealth is going.
Well, and that's the thing is, though, that's no different than any other big corporation being subjected to, you know, the laws of America. You know, it's just... it doesn't matter that you're a tech company. It's literally just that's a tax law that they've written it in ways that any big company can, you know, get out of paying taxes. But that's not something that only affects the tech industry. Mm-hmm. That's something that affects all business in the United States, not just the tech company.
We're talking with Steve Knoll of Madison College right now. We're talking about the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, about how social media affects us in ways that we do and do not realize. And a big part of the documentary actually does talk about how a concern that social media platforms can be used and abused in ways that can really affect democracy. Ted in Racine is on the line with something about that to say. Hi, Ted.
Hi. Yeah, I was just, I'm really concerned about how foreign actors or maybe some bad actors are using social media to divide us as a society in the United States, and potentially like rigging up elections and other kinds of like things that are, you know, really kind of scary. I just wanted to, you know if you might comment on that.
Sure. Thanks for that call, Ted. Steve?
Well, I mean, the fact that other countries are spreading misinformation and posing as American citizens to post divisive stuff, that is absolutely going on. And I know that, you know, the term fake news gets thrown around a lot. That term is generally used incorrectly. But there are other countries, there's actually companies that manufacture artificial news stories, fake news stories, with the intent of spreading misinformation. Because if you see a news story that triggers you an emotional response, you know, people click on it and they share it out to all their followers without ever vetting as to whether or not that's truly a real news story or some kid in Ukraine wrote it, because having 10,000 people click on it is going to make him, you know, hundreds of dollars. So mm-hmm. This has become an industry in some countries in Eastern Europe, basically manufacturing divisive fake news and then posting it in the U.S. And they're, of course, generating all this money and revenue from all the clicking and sharing. But that's very unethical. But, you know, it's coming out of, and this goes back to the whole idea that there's only one internet, and it's not just the U.S. internet. So there are other laws in other countries and different attitudes about it. I find that highly unethical myself. But it doesn't stop other people of saying, well, it's not like we're selling cigarettes. We're selling, you know, stories. And if Americans are so stupid that they're going to click on a story that is so obvious it's fake, and then we generate advertising revenue, then so be it. And, you know, you can argue the ethics up and down about that. But that's not going to go away, because people, you know, there's this human thing about wanting to share bad news. And then there's this human thing about wanting to say, I told you so. And those two attitudes play into this spreading of misinformation. And this is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. People on both sides are equally guilty of doing this. It's when you see stories that trigger your emotion and you either say, see, I told you all along, this person is this or this person is that. And people want to be that first person to share it to their friends. People really need to stop and think before they share. That's the biggest problem in America on social media, is this need to be the first to share bad news or provocative news. And when I look at something, you know, you'll see like a news story came across that, you know, a certain celebrity passed away or something like that. My first thought is, okay, before I share this, I'm going to vet it. I'm going to check a couple other legitimate news sources and see if they're reporting on it before I would add my voice to it. And I think if more people would stop before they click, we could really cut that down significantly. But unfortunately, that's really kind of hardwired into us, not only as humans, but especially as Americans. That's part of our culture, to want to gossip and want to be the first person to be able to tell everyone in the neighborhood about this new thing. And, you know, that's not anything new. That's how our culture's been for decades. But now we do it digitally. And as a result, what might take a week for the gossip to go around the neighborhood can be spread via Twitter in 10 minutes. And that's truly scary and tragic at the same way.
We're running short on time, but I want to take a quick call from Scott in Fort Atkinson. Scott, hi.
Hi. Actually, just listening to what he said, it very much so is in par with what I wanted to say. Just stopping to think before you post. I was saying that I came of age with social media. I was young when I first started using it. I'm an adult now. I look back and shudder when I think about some of the things I used to post. I think kids have a tendency to overshare. You never know who you're going to end up working with or who's going to end up being a part of your family or a friend. I think parents should take a more active role in what their kids or young adults are posting on social media. And I just think it's something that everybody should think about.
Thanks so much for that, Scott. And Steve, as we wrap up with the last minute or so, what can we do if we want to be active on social media? And for some of us, we need to be for our jobs. Can we be more savvy consumers?
Well, we can be if we take the effort to do it. And I agree. I think, you know, and I'm not putting the burden on parents, but certainly they should be monitoring what their kids are posting. You know, younger people tend to overshare personal details, but the whole thing about sharing like fake news stories and a lot of political stuff, that is definitely a problem with the older generation. You know, people who, you know, the older you are, the more likely you're going to be sharing political misinformation. People who are 25 are oversharing about, you know, what they did last night with their friends. Okay. But people who are 60 are the ones who are really the biggest fault of sharing political information without properly vetting it for it. So I think it's really important to think about the click before you share, but depending on what generation you're in, it's for different reasons.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Steve Knoll is a marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. He joined us to talk about the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. The U.S. Census has had an interesting year. It's seen political battles over the inclusion of a citizenship question, a delay in door-to-door operations, and now a legal fight over how long it can keep gathering responses. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross tried to set September 30th as a deadline, but after a federal judge ruled against that, it became October 5th. And after yet another court decision over the weekend, it currently stands at October 31st. Getting a count of Americans has never been easy, and this isn't the first census we've taken during challenging times. So we're taking a look back at the obstacles the census has faced in the past and how it's dealt with them. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how the U.S. Census works now or has worked in the past? Are you wondering how the census has changed over time? Do you worry about the accuracy of this year's census given the pandemic and political battles? Is the census important to you to fill out every 10 years? And have you ever been a census worker? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Margo Anderson is a distinguished professor emerita of history at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of the book, The American Census, A Social History. Margo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I don't think it's an understatement to say that this year's census has been interesting for more than one reason, including this shifting deadline of when responses can be taken in person and online. Before we look at the history, how do you feel about the way things have played out this year?
Well, it's like everything else in the United States this year, it's been quite a ride. The census was about to go into the field. April 1st is Census Day every 10 years. And of course, we all know now that that's exactly when the COVID pandemic hit really hard and the country locked down, so that it meant that a lot of the operational work involving sort of the human element of counting had to be pushed back, and is still going on at the moment. The electronic version of the census, which is the new internet option, seems to have worked quite well and went forward in any case, and so did the mail, the older forms of mail and phone. But the in-person work has been really disrupted by the pandemic.
We've talked with you before about the history of if and how citizenship gets measured by the census. Can you remind us briefly of how that aspect, which was kind of one of the first obstacles for this year's census, has played out over time?
Okay, the U.S. Has been interested in the citizenship status of the foreign-born population for a very long time, and so the questions go back into the 19th century. We've never asked the question of native-born Americans because they have birthright citizenship. So what happened in 2018 is that the Commerce Secretary, Wilbur Ross, proposed putting it as a question on the census form for everyone. In the context of the kind of very contentious debates about citizenship and immigration in the United States, that drew opposition and legal challenges, which were ultimately resolved in favor of the plaintiffs. So the question did not go on the census, and that was essentially resolved by about June or July of 2019.
So the COVID-19 pandemic obviously has delayed in-person operations for a while, and then there have been political wranglings also about moving this time frame when the answers are the responses are submitted and when they are submitted to the White House. Have there been other times in history when a national crisis has coincided with a census and made it difficult to operate?
There have always been, you know, hiccups and glitches and problems. I mean, think of natural disasters, hurricanes or, you know, or the fires on the West Coast and so forth, which were also experienced this time. So what is different this year is that this is the first time that the entire nation has been hit by an unplanned event, namely the pandemic. So it's not just a local problem, it's a national one.
I've been asked this a lot lately, and Americans have gotten through those hiccups, if you will, and problems with the census in past decades. I've been using those as sort of analogies about how we could do that again this time, you know, because we do need to use the results of the census to reapportion Congress, as the Constitution requires, and then for myriad other uses for the next 10 years.
We're talking right now with Margot Anderson. She's a distinguished professor emerita of history at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of the book, The American Census, A Social History. And we are talking about the many obstacles and challenges that the census is having this year. It is interesting, Margot, because the census is used for a lot of things like apportioning federal money, apportioning congressional representation. Mm-hmm. You know, if we go back not even that far ago, let alone the early decades of the census, the population was smaller and transportation and technology wasn't what it is now. Did we have different expectations for what the census could gather back then compared to today?
Well, the goal was always, as in the current language, to count the population once, only once, and in the right place, which is the constitutional requirement. It used to take a lot longer, because transportation was much slower, and frequently Congress would have to extend the deadlines, for example, of getting the results in, there are even cases where Congress reapportioned itself knowing that they were missing data, or that the data that they had, they thought, and the census officials at the time thought as well, had problems. But they did it anyway because of the importance of the
of this. It's very much like an election. There are winners and losers, and we reallocate every decade. And by and large, we don't cancel elections. We keep we use the results of them, and that has also been by and large true of the census. We use it, and we make the best of what we have. And that's a debate that we'll have as a country. Pretty much as soon as the in-person counting stops, which should be the end of this month, end of October. And I have a feeling that debate is going to go on into the 2020s for a couple of years.
The census is never going to be able to get a response from every single person in the country. Right. But that said, is there generally a response rate that the census aims for and is considered a valid census if it meets that threshold?
Okay. Well, of course, they strive like we all do for perfection. And actually what they're doing, it is not counting people. They're counting addresses and who's living at that address as of April 1st, the April 1st date. So what their goal is as a counting operation is to account for all those well over 100 million addresses on their list. And try to get up to 99.9% of those addresses, what they call accounted for. Remember that some of those addresses are vacant, right? So they have to, nobody was living in that building in April. You see that, for example, in vacation areas. Northern Wisconsin particularly is a very tricky area to count because of that. And so the goal is to account for the address list and to do it fairly so that we don't create advantage or disadvantage for any particular piece of geography, ethnic group, political constituency, economic area. In other words, it's like an election. We need to have the results to be understood as fair. Hmm. We could undercount or overcount the population if we did it uniformly all over the country, and it wouldn't make any difference. It's the differential, like your town got counted better than my town. That's the problem. That could be the problem.
So that's an interesting point, Margo. I hadn't really thought about it this way. Whereas, say, an election is based on the individuals, the census is actually based on the place of residence.
Right. Well, mechanically, in other words, they have to, if you remember the postcard or the address, the little thing that you got in the mail in the spring, most of us, there was no name on it. Mm-hmm. It just went to the address. And so the Bureau spends a lot of time and money on our behalf creating what is called a master address file for the entire United States and putting each one of those addresses on a big map. That it's the same map, by the way, that all the the Amazon and UPS and stuff uses to deliver stuff to all of us, and it's the because they don't know who's going to be living there on April 1st. They just have to go to the residents and say who's there, and get a few answers to questions about characteristics of people, and then say thank you very much, and we'll see you in 10 years.
We're talking with Margo Anderson, Professor Emerita at UW-Milwaukee and author of The American Census, A Social History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of the U.S. Census? Are you curious about how it's dealt with challenges in the past? Or maybe who it's counted over the years and who's been left out? Are you concerned about the accuracy of this year's census amid COVID-19 and legal fights over its deadline? And if you've ever been a census worker, we'd love to hear your experiences. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the U.S. Census with Margo Anderson. She's a professor emerita at UW-Milwaukee and author of the book, The American Census, A Social History. Margo, it seems like with technology, the internet especially, it would be easier to survey more people and see self-response rates go up Have we seen evidence of that?
Actually, well, of course, this is the first time that the census has relied heavily on an internet response. There are lots of other surveys that the Census Bureau and the federal government do that use internet responses, but this is the first time we've used it massively for the census. And there were a bit of worries last year and the year before about whether the bandwidth would be enough, whether people could get in and so forth. It seems to have worked pretty well. And that, of course, takes an enormous technical burden off the census, because you realize that if people fill it out on paper, which has been the method for, a couple hundred years, you have to transfer the information from the paper to a digital format so that it can be added up. Well, by using the internet, you go straight to a digital format, and that should save a lot of money and time for the next stage of the work, which is the processing. Now, we also know that there's going to be, partially because of the pandemic, that there are going to be a lot of questions about accuracy. Think, for example, of college students who should have been counted at their dorms, for example, on April 1st, but had already left their university addresses and gone home. Where do you count them? So the professionals who are worrying about this are expecting not only a lot of, a lot of complicated decisions, but a lot of double counting. In other words, people may have filled out the form twice, because they were doing that like in the last week of March, just as the pandemic was really altering where people lived in the United States. Mm-hmm. So that work of what they call post-processing is in front of us still. We don't really know yet how severe it is.
We're talking with historian Margo Anderson right now about the U.S. Census, the obstacles it has faced in the past, and what we're looking at today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And Jamie in Lodi is up. Hi, Jamie.
Hello, thank you. My originally was asking about safeguards, what things are put in place for fraud. So, like, if an Illinois person owned a property in northern Wisconsin, what about them putting in fraudulent numbers? But then the other thing I was wondering is, what about having an online database so it's actually updated more frequently? That's the second question that I just kind of came up with. Thank you.
And what do you mean by an online database exactly, Jamie?
Well, obviously, if I move on the next, if I moved in from April to someplace in October, if I moved three times, I lived in three different residencies since it was originally sent out to when it's replied. So if the population decreases by five people, like, what about having something that's a little bit more up to date more often, mm-hmm. so we actually have a real time number of what things are actually at?
Got it. Thanks so much for that, Margo.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the mechanisms that a lot of other countries use. It's a different kind of counting, population counting. It's called a register, a population register, and it is continuous. So Scandinavian countries have used this system for a very long time, where you essentially report where you live, and if you move, you report that, and your record shifts from your old residence to your new residence. So you can do that. The U.S. has never been terribly keen politically on doing that, on having a population register. It's been proposed numerous times, but it's always been sort of seen as cumbersome, and especially because we have a federal system of management. Think of driver's licenses, for example, where if you move from one state to another, you have to get a new driver's license. So it's never happened. Now, a question about somebody filling out the form twice, once in Illinois and once in northern Wisconsin, that's exactly what is yet to happen, and what in terms of the checking on that. The Census Bureau essentially has in its own databases, estimates of
first of all, we know what the population in those areas was 10 years ago. And we also know, you can also put the names and the addresses and the information against itself. So if you find, three John Smiths with exactly the same information, you're going to have to decide which one is the duplicate.
Thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and Samantha in Whitehall is up. Hi, Samantha.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. Great show. Anyway, I was just wondering, how do people in nursing homes and assisted living and also in prisons and jails get counted?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thanks for that, Samantha. And Margo, I'll also add in there, Greg called and wondered about the homeless population, how they are accounted for.
Anybody who's in something like an institutional setting, that's everything from college dorms to prisons to hospitals and nursing homes and so forth, lives in something that is called group quarters. And the Bureau has separate procedures. Basically, they contact the administrators of the institution and they count people. So it's a collaboration between the management of the institution and the Census Bureau. So yes, you're exactly right. That's exactly what they have to do. And you can go on the Census Bureau website and put in group quarters and find out all about how they do that.
Great.
The same thing is true for the homeless or what they call a service-based enumeration, where they send out, that was done in late September, people to known places. Again, they get the information from local governments that people living not in standard housing would be that night, and they count them there. They count them where they're encountered.
We have just about a minute and a half left, but I want to try to sneak Rafaela in Wausau in. Rafaela, thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I was a census worker this year, and I'm bilingual. I speak Spanish. I found it very challenging when speaking with people of Hispanic origin, majority being from Mexico, to explain to them that they, being Mexican, they were not, that was not their race. And then they had to try to choose from the race category.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So that was hard.
Yeah.
They're like, but I soy Mexicano, ¿qué puedo decir? So they're like, so then I had to try to guide them. And I didn't want to answer for them. I want to dignify them with them being able to say that for themselves.
Yeah. Yes.
Thanks for that, Rafaela.
Yeah. You're raising the kind of question in a very diverse country, and people with different linguistic backgrounds always face, which is, what do these questions mean? And they don't quite fit. They do represent an Anglo sort of political tradition, and the word race, raza in Spanish, doesn't quite mean the same thing. And so you're identifying an issue that is one of the reasons that they want enumerators like you to be on the ground trying to help people respond.
Thank you so much for that call. And Margo, just about 10 seconds left. If people have not yet filled out the census, can they go to the census website?
Yes, they can. They can go to census.gov and you'll be able to find a link to how to respond.
Great. Thanks so much, Margo. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Margo Anderson is a professor emerita of history at UW-Milwaukee and author of the book, The American Census, A Social History. We talked with her about how the U.S. Census has dealt with challenges in the past and how it's functioning in 2020. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk to a political scientist about the history of presidential illnesses in light of President Trump's recent COVID-19 diagnosis. All that and more coming up on Central Time tomorrow at this time.